We're told the Florentine Camerata was really a group of intellectuals and poets mostly, not musicians, although some did play, who decided that they wanted to try to recreate Greek drama as a mix of music and words. They knew that there had been music involved in Greek drama, but none of that music has survived. We have the texts, the literary texts, but we don't have the music. They had all these wonderful theories, in other words, but no proof of anything, so they constructed. I think we can see opera as the imaginative reconstruction of Greek drama, and they chose Greek themes from the beginning. Daphne was the first opera that we know of, and then after that comes a whole string of operas on the Orpheus theme. And when you think about it, Orpheus is such a wonderful figure to use at the beginning of this new form called opera. First of all, it's realistic, right? You're creating an art form, a dramatic form, that is sung, and it's logical to pick a singer as protagonist. Orpheus is particularly useful, though, since he's both the great poet and the great singer, words plus music. So he becomes this sort of self-reflexive figure at the beginning of opera, one who represents the singing poet, the son of Apollo. Words of Linda Hutchin from an interview titled Bodily Charm, Live Opera by Dawn McCants. This is the famous toccata from Claudio Monteverdi's opera, Orfeo, and we're greeted at the start with these bold words, I am music. La musica here reminding us of the power of music to calm our troubled minds or melt our hearts. And now La musica says, I will sing you songs, some happy, some sad. That from the opening of the opera, L'Orfeo, Orpheus, by Claudio Monteverdi. Monteverdi might be proclaiming a musical manifesto of sorts here. He went on to spend his life creating music that lives on even today. And in this, the 450th anniversary year since his birth, the music world is celebrating. Happy Birthday, Claudio, a feast of Italian Renaissance and Baroque music, is a celebration of the 450th anniversary of Monteverdi's birth, and it will be Sunday, March 26th at 4 in the afternoon at Moravian College in Bethlehem. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dr. Larry Lipkus, Starner Professor of Music and Composer in Residence at Moravian College, about the program and about Claudio Monteverdi.
I think he's a very important composer, very pivotal, somewhat revolutionary in his time because he really forms a bridge between two eras of music, the Renaissance and Baroque, and he was really making tremendous sea changes to music. He actually called all previous music prima practica, and then his music, the new era of music, was secunda practica, so the second practice of music. So it was a huge break, and that's really how we define the difference between medieval Renaissance on the one hand and Baroque music on the other.
And he was someone who did the range of music making and creating. He did madrigals, opera, he did sacred music.
He did, and even within the genre of the madrigal, he really transformed it because madrigals in the Renaissance were simpler affairs. They were unaccompanied a cappella pieces and often very lightweight, but sometimes very, very, very well crafted. The English school and the Italian school. And in his hands, I mean, he wrote wonderful madrigals in that style, but then they evolved. He wrote 9 books of madrigals, and when you get into the 7th, 8th, and 9th, you begin to see that the whole genre is being transformed. He's including instruments. He's making longer pieces and with much more varied texts, and it's quite thrilling to watch the evolution of this one genre in his hands over several different decades.
How do we account for this? It's just genius? Is it just a matter of somebody who has innate talents and can imagine things that the rest of us can't? Or are there things in the larger world that are feeding into the mix?
I think it's really both. I think he's definitely a genius. But I think there was in the air, there was a group called the Florentine Camerata, which is a group of intellectuals, writers, and musicians who are just rethinking music and literature and the combination of both, and putting text as the primacy when you had those two genres together, and you had new ways, kind of going back to earlier forms of expression, experimentation. They were an intellectual group, but they really gave Monteverdi and his generation a kind of foundation upon which to build their new work. So Monteverdi is one of the first composers to write operas, perhaps not the first, but members of that Florentine Camerata and associates wrote what we now consider operas, these dramas in music, as he would call them. Orfeo, for example, is from 1607. This is really the first generation of the 17th century. The first decade of the 17th century just saw this really astonishing kind of a creation of a new genre, the opera, which didn't really exist before.
Is it a coincidence that Orpheus is the centerpiece of a work like this, a major work like this, celebrating the voice, the one who can charm the animals?
I think that's very good. I think he was seen as a model of Greek mythology. How the way the Greeks presented music was really much at the origins of this new thinking, this secunda pratica. And I think Orpheus himself is certainly a symbol, somebody who was known to charm rocks and charm wild beasts with his music. I don't think it's a coincidence. Of course, Monteverdi did have other subjects as well, such as Copaea, the Coronation Copaea, and so historical subject matters were of interest to him as well. But Orpheus himself does serve as a wonderful touchstone, I guess you could say, to this new era.
And what was the fate of this body of music after his passing? Did he remain in favor and an influence? How did that play out?
Of course, the Italians were really the dominant force in music making in the early Baroque period, the Italians and the Germans principally. And then the Italians sometimes feel that they were the ones that invented vocal music. And to a certain degree, you have to hand that to them, because the language is so beautiful to sing in, and they were not just pioneers, but they advanced the language so beautifully in vocal arts that you really just had a continuation of great operas, you know, going into the classical era, Mozart's wonderful operas in Italian, and then, of course, the 19th century, where there's the blossoming of bel canto and Rossini, Donizetti, into Verdi. So you had this centuries-long dominance of the Italians, and it really did begin with Monteverdi. Monteverdi himself, as much of Baroque music did, waned in interest and then was revived largely in the 20th century, often by, Nadia Boulanger, the great French pedagogue, was one of the first people in the 20th century to really bring Monteverdi back to life. She was very important in that move, and then others followed suit. So there was a time when his music went into something of a decline, but now it's being, you know, brought back, and he's certainly recognized as one of the great creative geniuses in music history.
Your assignment then would be to go through this amazing body of work and select things that would bring this genius to light and give us a varied program. How did you go about it?
Well, it was a wonderful task. I decided, first of all, to have the entire program be all Italian music and just have the second half feature Monteverdi, so we'd lead up to Monteverdi. The program went through several different iterations. I was going to have music before Monteverdi, music after Monteverdi, and then Monteverdi. And to some degree, I did that, but I just really wanted to pick Italian music from the Renaissance and Baroque period that I really liked myself and that would be appropriate for my students to perform. I think it's one thing to have great visions, but you really have to select music that is going to work with your ensembles as well. You have to keep that in mind. And so for me, I have a very talented madrigal group, which we actually have always been known as the Montes, for the Monteverdi Ensemble. And this year it happens that five of them are outstanding brass players as well. So with that in mind, I did try to select some pieces where they could be featured playing their brass instruments and then also singing. Not exactly at the same time, but within the same piece. So that made it a kind of interesting challenge as well.
Just review for our listeners the profile of the early music ensembles and the early music program at Moravian.
Well, it's really grown. There's a tremendous amount of interest in early music. We have an instrumental group called just the Baroque Ensemble. Sometimes it's been known as Team Telemann, because Telemann seems to be a favorite of all the students. So that is generally a group of flutes, recorders, violins, and harpsichord and cello. And then we have the vocal group, which is the Monteverdi Ensemble. We also have the Renaissance group, which is a kind of college and community group that's called the Collegium Musicum. And those three have been the three main ensembles, but we also have little spin-out groups. There's a lot of interest in playing crumhorn this year, so I have now a crumhorn ensemble, which I haven't really had something like that in about 20 to 25 years or so. And they're passionate about playing the crumhorn. There are four people, so they will actually be in the concert as well. We have a little group of Baroque brass players.
Do you have any sense about why this has been happening?
Well, when I first started teaching, that's been 40 years ago, I brought in my own early music, my passion for it, because I did that a lot as an undergraduate and as a graduate student. And then I joined the Baltimore Consort in 1984. And so that's a professional early music group that tours and gives concerts regularly. And so I've tried to bring that music, some of the music we perform there, I introduce that to the students as well. So I think you really need somebody who's actively involved in the early music scene as a performer to help build a program. And once it started, it just has been off and running, and we've never really had a problem filling these ensembles. It's just a question of finding who's available and who wants to do it. But I think it's pretty special and unique for a school of our size to have such a large early music experience for the students.
What are some of your favorites that you might have been playing on tour with Baltimore Consort or in your own professional life? Will we hear some of that music this time?
Well, the Baltimore Consort put together a program in honor of the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death in 1616. So in 2016, well, since 2014, we've done a new Shakespeare program. And I've used some of that music with my own groups. So last year we did, or maybe 2 years ago, we did an all-Shakespeare program here at Moravian, where we interspersed some of the dialogue of the plays with music that might have been heard during Shakespeare's time. And so that involved some acting, and that was a lot of fun for the students. The Baltimore Concert still performs that program quite a bit. So there's quite a bit of mixing in what I do. If it's appropriate, what I do with the Baltimore Consort, I introduce to the students. And so the students have the advantage then of playing music that we've been playing for a long time in the group. So I have some good ideas about how to put it together. A lot of early music creation involves not just reading the notes that a composer wrote. If you're going to play a Beethoven string quartet, you have all the notes there. And you don't really try to do anything other than what Beethoven tells you to do in the score. But with early music, oftentimes you're dealing with just a melody, and you put together the accompaniment, or you might have four parts to work with, but the instrumentation is not specified, so you can be inventive. Do you use strings here? Do you use winds here? What pieces would you connect to other pieces? So there's quite a bit more latitude with early music performance in terms of being creative as a director, which I enjoy quite a bit. And the more students I have involved in the program, the more creative I can be, of course.
Would you pick out a madrigal that you might do and talk to us a little bit about it, a Monteverdi madrigal?
Yes. Well, the second half begins with one of the great madrigals by Monteverdi called Zeffiro Torna, and it's from Book 9, which is his final book, and it's a madrigal for two tenors and continuo. And it's a wonderful, wonderful text about Zeffiro Torna, return, O Zephyr, or wind. It's a madrigal that has all the word painting possibilities you'd ever want, because the text is so evocative of what wind can do, and it's filled with language like, make the flowers in the fields dance to your sweet sound, crown with a garland the heads of Phila and Chloris, with notes tempered by the love and joy from mountains and valleys, high and deep, and sonorous caves that echo in harmony. So this is just, for Monteverdi, he just loves a text like this because he can be extremely evocative and paint the words in music, which he does brilliantly. This is considered one of the great supreme examples of word painting in music. It's so much fun. It's very, very hard. It's a virtuosic madrigal, and our two tenors have spent the better part of an entire year learning this because it's very, very tricky. But it's a wonderful piece, and it's sometimes thought of being the queen of the madrigals. It's or the ne plus ultra. It doesn't really get more evocative and expressive than this. And it ends with, now I weep, now I laugh. And it goes back and forth between weeping and laughing. It's just so much fun to watch these two tenors sort of get into the text with this particular madrigal. So this is an example of a late, very late madrigal where Monteverdi's really at the peak of his powers.
And Larry, where do you like to do these performances of early music on campus? Is there a great space for this?
There is. Pater Hall is a perfect space because it's a very warm, resonant room, not overpoweringly resonant, but singers love to sing there because they don't have to work hard. The acoustics sort of helps the voice, and so it's a very warm, encompassing environment. It's a beautiful room as well because it has stained glass windows, and so when we do an afternoon concert, as we are doing at 4 o'clock, and the sun streams through the windows, the setting sun, because it does face west, it's really quite a beautiful, beautiful scene. It's just really remarkable to bathe in the light coming through and then hearing the beautiful music. So it's a very nice space for us. We have students, when they've come to audition to be music majors, they come into the room and they're just so impressed by the beauty of the room and the acoustics. They immediately decide to come to Moravian simply because of that room. So we're never going to get rid of it.
Is it an old building?
Well, yes. The building that I'm actually sitting in right now talking to you is built in 1748. Pater Hall is a little bit later than that. It's 1867. But still, that's quite old, and so it does give off that sort of scent of history, I guess you could say. You know, one senses the generations of students and performers coming before. It's just a wonderful space to perform in.
Tell us now, these students will be presenting this program and this remarkable music, and you told us that the tenors have been working a very long time to get ready, and everyone is excited about this, and you've got the Krumhorns and that sort of thing. Even if these performers don't go on to be specialists in early music, what kinds of lessons might they learn from immersing themselves in Monteverdi in this 450th year?
Well, I think any time you really go deeply into any composer's work, you just come away a transformed person. And it can be a Mozart, it can be Stravinsky, to just spend a lot of time with one piece or with one composer and just broadens you. And you really learn insights about not just that composer, but music, expression, how one creates a work like this. We had a student spend an entire year preparing Stravinsky's Soldier's Tale, and I think every student involved in that just grew tremendously as an ensemble just by focusing, going very deep into one particular work like that. Just no other way to describe it. I guess it's like studying King Lear or a great Shakespeare play or some fine work of art for a very long time. You just find that it almost empowers you to think more creatively yourself. But I don't want to give the impression that this is all high, inaccessible art by any means. This program is a very lively, fun one because we're trying to celebrate, I guess, just the joie de vivre of Italian music in the Renaissance. And so we have pieces that were written for the Venetian and Florentine carnivals. And these are very light-hearted pieces that are a lot of fun, and we're doing a little bit of acting in some of these pieces. They're very charming works. They're not what you would call like the masterworks of Monteverdi, but I think a program needs some balance between fun and frivolity. And we're doing a motet also by the composer Gesualdo, who was a contemporary of Monteverdi's, didn't live as long as Monteverdi, but he really was a transformative composer in his way because his music is extremely chromatic and in some cases very tortured. Very, very challenging to sing and perform because it is harmonically very unpredictable. And for that reason, it's thrilling at a certain level because you hear sounds that are just not what you might expect from moment to moment. He was also a very notorious character as well because he murdered his wife and his wife's lover, and for that he was banished. And he was a prince, so he was of nobility. So he's a very complicated person. And his music is very complex as well. We're doing a motet called Ovos Omnes, which is very rich and profound. It's a Lenten piece, and it makes a nice contrast to some of the more frivolous pieces in the program. But it's a very, very beautiful piece. One of my students had been begging for years to perform Gesualdo, and I I put them off because I just really couldn't find a piece that would work. And then finally, I came across this one. I said, this one we can do, and I think we should do it on this program. The students love it, too. They just find it it's a piece you can really sink into and just enjoy the strange, otherworldly chord progressions.
And some of the opera, too.
Well, with the opera, we're doing one ravishingly beautiful duet from Monteverdi's last opera called The Coronation of Poppea. Scholars are not convinced entirely that all of this work is by Monteverdi, although he put his name to it. He might have had some help, almost like a little factory at that point, of people working with him or for him. But in any case, we consider it a work of his, and it's a culmination at the end of the opera, this love duet, which is one of the most beautiful love duets, I think, in all of opera, called Pur ti miro, between Nero and Poppea, the queen. Not very likable people in the opera, but they certainly come together and sing a gorgeous duet. And then we're doing excerpts from Orfeo, as you mentioned. That's a very, very long opera. We're just doing just a few bits of it to give people a sense of what Monteverdi's language is like. And so we have just some scenes of Orfeo singing an aria in honor of his beloved Eurydice. We have choruses of nymphs and shepherds. And we end with a little dance that concludes the opera. So it's a wonderful opera filled with passionate singing and a very tragic story, which in Monteverdi's version ends very happily with the original version of the myth. Orfeo gets torn to bits by the Bacchanauts, the followers of Bacchus. There's a kind of grisly ending to the original myth, but Monteverdi and his librettist made it a happy ending with a deus ex machina, the sun god Apollo coming down and bringing Orfeo back up into the heavens where he can forever look down upon his beloved Eurydice. So we have a little celebratory dance to end the opera.
Dr. Larry Lipkus, Starner Professor of Music and Composer in Residence at Moravian College in Bethlehem, speaking with us about a program titled Happy Birthday Claudio, a feast of Italian Renaissance and Baroque music in celebration of the 450th anniversary of Monteverdi's birth. The program will be presented Sunday, March 26th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in what Dr. Lipkus described as the beautiful Pater Hall at Moravian College in Bethlehem. For more information on the web, moravian.edu, moravian.edu. A celebration of the 450th anniversary of the birth of Claudio Monteverdi. Sunday, March 26th at 4 in the afternoon at Pater Hall at Moravian College on the campus in Bethlehem. For more information on the web, moravian.edu, moravian.edu.